If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around until the end of the episode for a promo of our friend and Arkansas Neighbors podcast, Strictly Homicide. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
It's just a heavy, heavy burden that he carries, and it doesn't go away. He knows the boogeyman is real.
After Carla Walker's abduction, Rodney McCoy, who'd been wounded by the perpetrator in the attack, moved into the Walker's home. He stayed in Carla's bedroom and waited by the Walker's side for any updates. He was with the family the entirety of Carla's disappearance. Leighton Walker, Carla's father, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, "The family is holding up better than Rodney." The Walkers consoled their daughter and sister's boyfriend, and he did his best to console them. There was never a doubt of Rodney's innocence in the Walkers' minds, not only because they bonded with him so easily and so naturally, but also because of the impossibility.
Oh yeah, he was with us all the time. In our mind, we never expected Rodney being involved in anything.
God bless Rodney. Could you imagine being an 18-year-old boy, making out with your girlfriend in the back parking lot of the bowling alley before you take her home, and having some guy jerk open the door, pull Carla out? You know, I think it really screwed up Rodney's psyche, probably to this day. And he's anal about locking up everything, keeping everything secured. The Rodney I knew wasn't that way. You know, he seemed like a happy-go-lucky high school kid. And never held one iota of resentment. You know, our family certainly did, and we always talked fondly about Rodney. And, you know, I have good memories of Rodney and good feelings toward him. And I think that this has just devastated his life.
On February 20th, 1974, 3 days after the attack on the couple and Carla's kidnapping, Benbrook Mayor Wayne Wilson, who was present at the Walkers' home, stated he collapsed and broke down after being told the body found today in the culvert fit the description of Carla, her dress, and her rings. Rodney was so upset he couldn't speak.
Rodney was just the nicest, most wonderful guy. Oh, that sounds stupid, but they were just like the perfect couple and the nicest people, and he was just devastated. And he would just lay up in her room, and they were so worried about him.
Since most violent crimes against women are perpetrated by a male close to them, Rodney McCoy was considered a person of interest immediately, as per standard procedure, but was eventually ruled out. Rodney was subjected to relentless, ruthless, and endless interrogations by the Fort Worth Police Department, the FBI, and the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office during the abduction. The questioning continued after Carla was found as well.
After Carla was found for a long time, like the police followed him. They didn't tell him that they were following, but he knew that he was being followed. And when he'd go home and leave school and stuff like that, I guess they were still just trying to wrap up and put their hands around, could he have done it? You know, did he know somebody? Has anybody contacted him? Things like that. But and it's really kind of weird because the FBI, I don't know if you've ever been interrogated by an FBI agent. Well, they're scary. I remember they put me out in one of their cars, and the two agents were in the front, and they didn't want to do it in the house because there was other people and other police agencies there, and it's very intimidating. I mean, this guy turned around real quick in the seat and said, well, you know she had an abortion. And I went, no. And he said, oh. And this is before they even found her. So they were trying to think of things that Rodney could maybe, you know, when she was pregnant or, but I mean, they were just trying to get stuff out of you. That could have been a reason that he had done this or he might have done that.
There was some peer speculation of Rodney's possible involvement, along with their hindsight evaluations of his attempts to stop the attacker from taking Carla.
I do remember conversations like that, of never to me, but hearing that he could have done something, he could have grabbed this guy. I mean, unless we're in that situation, who knows what would happen. But I do know that people probably thought that too. Why couldn't he have fought this guy off?
You know, I've got these theorists out there saying, well, you know, we think Rodney, you know, Rodney had nothing to do with it, period. He would have wanted to die versus letting her go. When people don't know how to respond, they distance themselves. You know, I think 999 out of 1,000 people are unintentionally ignorant. It's like if you have a disability or if you have cancer or if you get a divorce. You know, friends, people who know you kind of don't know what to say. There's a silent awkwardness. Anybody that would blame Rodney or even think about doing that, well, you know, God bless them. They don't have life experience. They don't understand.
During the police investigation, Rodney was subjected to a total of 3 polygraph tests, the first one being administered the day after Carla was taken, and all of which the young man passed. They also investigated the nature of Rodney's wounds. The reason the clip was on the ground was because the guy hit Rodney with the gun on top of his head. Jim Minter, a Tarrant County Sheriff's investigator at the time, told us, "We looked at his head. We got one of those pistols. We matched that to the top of his head. The Ruger pistol had a release on the bottom of the gun, and it extended out past the handle." He continued, "The reason he didn't get killed is because the first time he got hit, and we tested this, was because the clip was not engaged completely, so that saved his life." Rodney underwent hypnosis as well. With Jim Minter present, Rodney was asked to recount the attack. Minter said that under hypnosis, Rodney retold the perpetrator's exact words as, "She doesn't want to come with you. She wants to come with me." Minter said that Rodney was crying and screaming unconsolably. "I never believed in hypnosis at all. However, seeing Rodney cry and scream when he was under, I was impressed with that hypnosis," Minter disclosed to us. "But, you know, a big old boy, and he's just sitting there and tears are just running down his face, down the bottom of his chin, as he relives this," Minter continued. Rodney was so upset, in fact, that he had to be brought out of the hypnotic state for fear he would go into shock. Those who know Rodney have seen firsthand how Carla's abduction and murder affected him. His close friend, Kathleen, spoke with us about specific details of the guilt and anguish with which he's lived and the impact that night has had on his life.
Carla Walker's kidnapping and murder was one of the saddest things that ever happened to me, particularly because of the close relationship my husband had with Rodney McCoy. I met Rodney on the day of Carla's funeral. Charlie and I went over to his house to be with him that evening. And he was asleep when we got there. He was just totally exhausted from everything that had happened that week. I don't think he had much sleep. And Charlie went in and woke him up. And he came out and sat on the couch with us. And Charlie was on my left, and I was sitting in the middle, and Rodney was on my right. And we just talked. It was just devastating and overwhelming. He talked about Carla, about sweet memories, and he talked about what had happened. And one of the saddest things to me, he was just devastated because one of the things he said was Carla always wanted to have her doors locked. And so he was always really careful to lock her doors when she got in the car. But the night that the kidnapping happened, they had gone out in his mom's car. They usually went out in Carla's car or one of the Walker's cars. His mom's car had the older style door locks where you had to hold in the button under the handle
in order for the door to stay locked when you push the lock down and shut the door. And Carla's car had the newer style lock where you just had to push down the lock and then shut the door. And he was just devastated because all he could figure was he either hadn't remembered to hold the door, the button down to lock the door, or he hadn't held it in hard enough. And it was just something that always stuck with me. And every time I would hear someone say, well, if she'd only had her doors locked, it was just like another knife to the gut. That was just such a devastating time. What I do know is that over the years, it's never gone away. It's something that Rodney thinks about every single day. He tries to remember the good times and he treasures the good times, but it's affected not only his romantic relationships, but just all of his relationships. The sadness just permeates his life. And when it gets February, it gets worse. And the trauma of it, I guess, has affected how he has parented his children. He has tried to raise his kids to be aware, to be careful. But every time they go out the door, every time they leave the house, when they were younger especially, it hit him. You know, are they coming back? Especially his daughter, because he knows the boogeyman is real.
Rodney continued to suffer for years from this traumatic event. He was quoted telling the papers in the 1990s that he was unable to marry until 11 years after Carla's murder, that he was afraid to get close to anyone for fear he'd lose them. He often struggled with the guilt of surviving the attack, and though he did move forward with his life, Rodney still struggles with that same pronounced guilt to this day.
It was quite a tough ordeal. She was my first love. She was. I was working at my stepfather's gas station over off of in Southwest over there, Lake Creek, and I can't remember the name of the street. Anyway, he had a gas station over there, and I was working there, and I had got off work, and it was already getting late. Took a shower and everything, got cleaned up, went over and picked her up. And I remember I was late. She was mad. That was before cell phones and all that stuff. She was kind of mad at me about being late. So we went and ate and then went to the dance. I don't even really remember much about the dance at all or anything. So the only reason we were even there is because that freaking bathroom at Taco Bell was closed. Somebody had broke the sinks in it. And they locked it and said, no, we're not letting anybody in, you know. That changed, all of that fate changed everything. I never had gone to the bowling alley for anything. Yeah, that wasn't a place that I, you know, went to. In fact, we were just getting ready to go home because it was time to go home. And I know her family was over there and stuff, you know, so. But we were going to leave the bowling alley, and we started, you know, kissing and everything. And I'd moved over towards, because it was a bench seat, and her head was up against the door, and we were kissing and everything, and the door just popped open. She almost fell out of the car. And when I grabbed her, that's when he started beating on my head. And that's, you know, I didn't know the clip fell out or anything, but he just, I don't know how many times he hit my head, but it was pretty good strikes. And she screamed, you know, quit hitting him. And she said, which is the hardest thing for me is I'll go with you if you just quit hitting him. And everything just, you know, that I kind of can remember just that feeling just out and waking up and it's quiet and nobody's there. And the last thing she said is go get dad. And I woke up and their house wasn't that far from there. And so I remember driving off there wasn't that many cars in the parking lot at all. It was kind of late. And driving off and driving, and the door, the passenger door slung open, and I don't know, I just kept driving, trying to reach over and shut it, and finally got to their house, and it was just total panic. I didn't know what to do. 18 years old, you know, it's like, you don't expect anything like that to happen to you. And I just, I know what I would do, you know, they would have to kill me. That's exactly what would happen. Somebody would have to kill me. And that was his intent. He had all intentions in the world in killing me. You know, from what I understand, it's more like a military gun that was probably used, because, you know, the only thing that saved my life was the clip fell out. That's the only thing that saved me. After he beat me over the head with, you know, the butt of the gun, and then he turned it around and put it right in between my eyes. Because when I went out and woke back up, I thought I was shot, because I was just covered. I couldn't even see because there was so much blood. I had to wipe, you know, get all the blood out of my eyes and everything. And I thought, you know, that's all I remember is him pulling the trigger in my face. And like, you know, probably, I don't know, 5-6 inches away from my forehead. It was like he just kept pulling it, like, I don't know. I just remember like 3 times or something, click, 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 that, you know. And my mind, when I woke back up and all the blood and everything, because I don't know, I was, as soon as he hit the back of my head, it was like that. I was pretty much in Neverland. I couldn't grab. I couldn't. That's just the way I remember it. And just out. I've tried so hard to picture that car, but it seems like the only thing I saw was there was a light on inside the car, and you know like the door was open. And the light, you know, that the dome light, and it's gone after that. Nothing, and just waking up to total silence. Then the car is gone. I had a feeling that I would not see her again. I you know, that next day, and people, you know, going through everything. It was like I just had that feeling that this person meant. I think we're doing, and there wasn't going to be any mercy on anybody, because I knew he totally wanted to kill me. I mean, of all things, people were calling their house saying, we know who did it. We know we got him right. You know, they were doing stuff like that. It was like, and you know, Mr. Walker would get excited. All right, I'm gonna go meet this person and all of that. And it seems like that. I mean, that's what I remember from it. It's that people were calling and, you know, as pranks. It was just like, it's unbelievable. It was tough. It was tough. But I wanted to be there. That's definitely, I wanted to be there. I do remember that. People were saying, like I was saying, they, because that it seems like that's what they said when I got to the house, that they got Carla. And I don't think it was more than one person. I don't. I just remember the detectives, you know, thinking that it was somebody from Western Hills High School that knew us. And to me, that was a dead end. Because I know for a fact she would have yelled their name, or, you know, I just know that it's obvious to me that if we would have known them, or, you know, they actually knew us, that something, it would have turned out different. I truly believe that. I just don't think, I really don't. I mean, I might be delusional, but I just don't think it was anybody. And it was an older person. It was definitely an older person. She was a sweetheart. She was funny. She liked to laugh. She's smart, very smart. She was a lot better student than I was. Because she was just naturally smart. You know, most of the time we that's what we did. We hung out at over at her house, or we would go to, you know, weekends, we'd go to parties and stuff like that. Back then, you know, there was parties every weekend, just about. We just always had a lot of fun. One of the favorites is when I went to San Antonio with her, and you know, her dad was in the hospital there, and we went down there, and we went all over the Riverwalk and all of that. We hadn't been dating, I don't guess, that long, but I got to know the family and everybody, and it was really fun. And her dad, oh my God, her dad, he called her his little flower. To me, out of all the kids, you know, him and her really, they clicked. And like before school in the morning, he would go out and give them cold mornings and warm her car up for her and stuff like that before she left. And just a loving father. That was really a tough part of the whole ordeal. Is, I'll just tell you now, I didn't protect his little flower, and it was really tough, you know, to think, you know, I really let him down. He was a tough guy, you know. He was a lieutenant colonel, I believe, and he's a good guy. He had a heart condition where he was taking, you know, nitro for blood thinning and all of that. And there was a few times, you know, he had episodes of a heart attack. She'd call me up, you know, crying about she didn't want to lose her dad, you know. The hardest part, you know, was it was hard for me to see them. There'd be pictures, you know, there's pictures on the wall of her. And every time I go there, I just feel something tugging at my heart. It was hard. It was tough to walk through that door. And it was very difficult. It's something I don't like to rehash. I have found a mechanism, you know, of it's with you every day, but, you know, you don't dwell on it. You don't, because it will totally take your life over. It's just, you know, all of these years, and now that I've had kids, I just can't imagine the pain that, you know, her mom and dad and brothers and sisters. I can't imagine losing one of my kids. I just, especially some vile, crazy thing like that happening. It really rips your heart. It really does. I mean, it's something that you naturally try to block out of your mind. Through all the years and everything, it's there. It's there every single day. It's, you know, it's not like you can totally forget something like that at such a young age. It's, you know, all the people talk about childhood trauma and all of that stuff that ruins it. You know, it's there. It's there every day, but there's just certain things you block out. So I don't know. You know, all of these years, I've never had a dream about that night. Never had, you know, a nightmare. I've had dreams about her, many dreams about her. But as far as what happened that night, I don't know if it's just a, you know, my mental block or something. I don't know. I know when I was younger and everything, I would think, you know, I wish the damn clip wouldn't have fell out. You know, to this day, my daughter and all growing up, I was just telling her, you know, I don't want to scare you, but there is some mean, mean people out there. And they don't care about you. They don't care about your family. You know, be careful. Especially when she got, you know, into middle school and stuff like that. She, you know, she's a beautiful girl. And it just the thought of, you know, that would come to my head. Like, oh, yeah, we're going to the mall or something like that. And I'd just tell her, look, when you come out of the mall, just keep, know your surroundings, be, you know. And it's just, I just always instilled that in her because I know there is some mean, mean people out there. I used to get my kids and my wife then, you know, they would go somewhere without me and I would just, you know, I'd kind of panic. And if they were late or something coming back, I was a mess.
Beyond the trauma that Carla's abduction and death would cause Rodney, the stress that police and FBI put him and his family through must have been immense. He remembers some specific details of being investigated.
I mean, they came to one of a baseball game one time and gave me a ride home, you know. We were talking and everything because they were trying to figure out, you know, how did I get these big two gashes in the, you know, the back of my head? And I remember we were in the, you know, detective's office and they figured it out, but they had a kind of that type of gun. It didn't have any bullets in it or anything, but it had a clip, and they put a phone book on the back of my head and they hit the phone book and the freaking clip popped out. And then they matched up, you know, the two big old gashes where, you know, the clip was missing. They could match it up to what, you know, big gash in the back of my head and everything. And that's how they figured that, you know, what type of gun it was and all of that. Yeah. I mean, some hardcore, like long interviews and going over it and over it many, many times, just going over it, you know, and I came to grips. Yeah. I am a suspect. And I went through a lie detector test and just hours and hours of, you know, going over everything. And, you know, I think they even tapped our phone because I can just remember that the phone was just weird. It was like, this sounds weird. And it was like staticky and everything. And I just felt, oh my God, you know, this is serious. Of course I was a suspect, you know, and I came to grips with that. But, you know, it was a tough time, man. It was tough.
DNA science started becoming a standard in law enforcement investigations years after Carla's death. And in the mid-1990s, Rodney was asked for a sample. He complied, of course, and was once again cleared. In May of 2003... then Fort Worth Police Sergeant J.D. Thornton announced to the Fort Worth Press, quote, "We did some more DNA testing that came up negative on some of the existing names we had as suspects. We received the results of those, and they said they were negative as far as any matches," end quote.
They came down here, and what they were explaining to me, that they were saying that the technology is so much better now. And I know they had taken, you know, the blood from my car. They, you know, just wanted to run it through, you know, and just see. It was kind of strange to me that why do they want to take my blood again? Maybe they were just, you know, they found some other samples and they didn't know if it was mine or theirs or, you know, whatever. They just said it was because the technology had advanced so much that they could nearly get it or break it down. You know, that's kind of what I remember, because I was just going, yeah, you want to take my blood, that's fine. I have no problem with that. I've been trying to forget all of these years, right? Kind of trying to just get it out of my mind, get rid of it. And when it comes back up, it's like, it's pretty painful. I've been successful in keeping it the very back of my mind. You think about it and I get angry myself. There's actually people out there that just don't give a shit. To me, somebody at that bowling alley that was working there or was there, they know something. This person does not just walk in there and walk out. He saw us. I'm just thinking that, you know, that person was probably at that bar talking to the bartender or not talking to him. And I'm really shocked that the police didn't come away with something, you know, in that vantage point. Because, God, in this day and time, he would have been caught just like that.
I'm glad somebody's picking it up, and maybe this is, you know, I'm thinking this is probably one of the last chances. I mean, I hate to say that, but it's looking like that. So there hasn't been anything else. I just figured by this time, somebody somewhere would finally just go, look, I gotta do something. I gotta say something. I mean, you know, just to forget about somebody, especially, you know, something that's so brutal and take somebody's life, you know, so young, he was definitely gunning for, he was going for two people. The guy had no problem taking two lives that night. I don't know. Through all the years, you go through so many different, you know, and I'm sure that to me, it was somebody that frequented the bowling alley and, you know, would go there for a drink or whatever and hang out or whatever. I don't know. One of their places to go and just stumbled upon us, basically. I mean, I've always thought that it's some Fort Worth resident or Bembrook. Somebody's got to step forward. I'm really shocked this whole time somebody hasn't slipped up or something. I mean, how can you do something like that and just, you know, fall off the face of the earth and nobody knows anything? It's not logical. You would think, you know, after years and years and years that you could just about deal with anything with that. But the thing that I want to deal with is this person, you know. Somebody knows something. I know it in my heart. I know it. Somebody knows something. And, you know, miracles, I believe in miracles. and they do happen. And somebody just happened to be listening or something. You know, and possibly grow a conscience and tell about somebody or something. That would ease a lot of people's minds. People could, you know, finally rest.
If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, the evidence and the investigation. We'd like to thank Rodney McCoy, Robbie Patton, Kathy Klein, and former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter for their contributions to this episode. We'd like to extend a very special thanks to Kathleen Barnett, who has helped us immensely through the process of researching Carla's case and continues to help the Walker family seek answers. Of course, we'd also like to thank the Walker family. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas and post pictures pertaining to our cases, so please join in. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a rating and review on iTunes, sharing Carla's story with a friend, or stop by our Patreon page and leave a small donation. If you enjoy reading about true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The cases presented there are always immensely interesting, well-written, and thorough. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Are you a fan of true crime? Do you prefer listening to cases that you've never heard before? I'm Nikki T., the host of Strictly Homicide, a true crime podcast covering lesser-known cases right out of the natural state. Join us this July as we start our first ever series on cold cases. Did you know there are over 500 missing people in Arkansas? That's only the people that are reported. This July, I'll be covering a handful of cold cases that you may have never heard before. And of course, join us bi-weekly as I cover Arkansas cases that have fallen through the cracks. Find us on all major podcast apps, including Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play, and iTunes, where you can also rate and review us.